show. I am Emmy Louie, and today's topic is really about the long-term solution to the rising fuel costs, and it has to do with new urbanism. That's one of the concepts, and also in conjunction with a national transit proposal in the United States. And what is interesting about what we're talking about is really it involves really thinking about the big picture and knowing a little about everything, as well as knowing a little about current events and synthesizing the information, as well as learning from reading and talking to people, as well as gathering your own experience. And then the last thing is to be able to understand all of these topics and to be able to listen to them is that we need to have a moral guidance system, inner moral guidance system, and know what is really the highest good and best benefit for all of us in the United States as well as in the world. And newurbanism.org definitely is one of the places to be as far as understanding where we need to go for the next at least 5 to 10 years in the direction that we need to go as far as creating more compact cities and connecting those cities to a larger network of mass transit and rail transit. And today's guest we have is Andy Kuhn from newurbanism.org. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you.
It is a very daunting, to me, a little daunting kind of conversation that we're having because we are primarily having a conversation and I'm speaking to you as a citizen and asking you questions and I don't profess to know anything more than all of us listening, really just looking for the truth and asking questions and seeing how we can rethink our world problems and that to take responsibility as well as to see what are the big picture, what are the smaller events that happen, and what does that all mean for us. And so actually what I did was for every show I review what we talked about. I actually listened to the show, and there are some topics that kind of came up again from the last show, and there are some things that we talked about that are terms that get talked about in the development world, such as impact fees, infill development, the cost of investing in sprawl for 50 years that is based on cheap oil, being carbon neutral, having political will to do things, some land conservation. So where do you want to start, Andy, based on all of those things?
Well, I was just, I don't know if you're aware, but this week they had in the Senate and I believe the House, they invited in all the chairmen or senior executives from all the oil companies, and they were kind of grilling them on, you know, why the price of oil is so high, and because it's having so many reverberations across our society. And it was kind of amazing because they were trying to pin the blame on the oil companies and the executives and, you know, their profits that they've made. And basically, a lot of the oil company executives kind of laid out the real situation that, you know, world oil supplies are finite and are tapering off, and demand is still growing like crazy, and a lot of it's even outside their control, because when they buy the raw material, they have to pay the full price as well. So, and you know, I'm listening to all the senators interviewing them and everything, and I didn't really hear a single word about giving us other forms of transportation or walkable communities or getting people out of cars. All they were talking about was why is the price so high and do we need to drill in, you know, every national park to try to get more. And so it even at the highest levels of business and government, they still don't really understand the details of this or the ramifications of all this. And so, you know, that's a little bit unnerving. Because
I know it is disturbing, because I can tell you from my own personal experience, having been a campaign chairperson for a city council person when I helped him run for two terms is that I got to know, got a little taste of politics and how it goes. And we basically create a situation. I know for the politicians, in a lot of ways, for them, it's similar to, what is it similar to? It's similar to you're getting paid. Let's just say you get paid for a part-time job or a full-time job. But in point of fact, because the citizens want you to do so much, you're really doing four jobs for the price of a part-time job.
Right.
Because of just the whole system. And I know this is kind of a tip of the iceberg where I'm almost opening up a can of worms of how our system is, our political system, how we solve problems. But that's what it comes down to. If you think about it, to expect one senator or one representative to solve our problems, considering how is it one person representing 50,000 people, that's a huge stress on that one person.
Right.
And so they're always fighting fires. And that's it. That's all they're doing. They're
right.
Fighting fires.
Well, and the fires they're fighting now is, you know, oil prices just keep going up and up and up, and it's affecting so many things. I mean, it's making the airlines get to their knees, and, you know, delivery with trucking and cars, and affecting gas prices and food prices. And so people are just mad across the country, and they're all looking for answers, and no one really has them. That's what's crazy about it. I mean, even the senators were just, none of them were really getting to the point of the matter. They were talking, and the oil companies, several of the executives said, you know, we need access to more oil. It's like, well, wait a minute, you know.
And that's exactly.
We're addicted to oil, and to get more is, you know, you're going to use all that up in a short time as well and destroy all the national parks. And then we're still in the same boat.
Yes, and that was exactly contrary to what we talked about last time. So that's why it's important for you and I to be actually talking, because we're this, from our conversations and the ideas and all that, is really preventing the fires from happening to begin with.
And moving beyond just putting out fires.
Exactly,
to actually redesign
systems. Because the whole system.
The system is the problem.
It's the problem, exactly. And
to keep feeding the system doesn't make any sense. You have to, you know, get past the system and find a real solution that's long-term.
Yes, and that's why we're here on this unconventional radio station. What do you call it? Unconventional. I forgot what that term is. Non-mainstream. But I'm talking about oil consumption. I actually looked on a website, and these statistics come from like the World Data Bank of the UN and all this. But I looked at oil consumption by country, and I thought I'd just kind of shoot this by you, Andy. USA is the top
right.
Oil consumption, and this is, of course, this is data, and you can really pick it apart. But I just wanted to give you a broad brushstroke, because then you could say, well, where did the information come from? What year is it? It's pretty recent, let's just say, because it's based on census and all
mm-hmm.
that. USA is 20 million barrels per day.
Mm-hmm.
That's the top. The second one is China, which is 6 million barrels per day, and Japan is 5 million barrels per day. And then, okay, now you got that down?
I'm not writing it, but I'm listening.
Okay, now this is by country, right? Okay, and this is very basic statistics 101, basically. If you look at that was oil consumption by country. This is oil consumption per capita.
Per person.
Yes,
right?
Per person. The first one is actually the Virgin Islands. And don't ask me why. I just saw this on the website. It's 1,000 barrels per day. Netherlands Antilles was 380 barrels per day. Singapore was 185 barrels per day. Actually, these are barrels per 1,000. I'm sorry. Okay, it's not barrels per person. It's barrels per 1,000 people per day.
Okay.
Okay, so when you look at consumption per capita, now what I did was per country, I looked at USA, China, and Japan, and I looked at their per capita consumption, and US was if you translate the per capita per person is U.S. 70 barrels per day, and China is 5. Because basically what this is saying is that once you measure, once you factor in the per capita, China is actually not using very much per person.
Well, yeah, and I read something recently that, in America there's 1.2 cars per person or some, I'm just going by memory here, and in China it's like one car per every 300 people.
Exactly, because...
So it's a huge difference. But the problem is China is rapidly ramping up their energy use, and they supposedly are going to catch us, and that's a real problem because they have billions of people. And, you know, when they ramp up really fast and in a big way. And that's part of the reason why they say the world oil prices are going up so fast, because China is rapidly industrializing and they have so many people. And, you know, it will probably surpass the U.S.'s oil use in a very short time.
Exactly. And then when you look at statistics, if you enter China into any equation, it's going to mess up all the statistics.
Yeah.
It will, because you've got a huge number of people.
Right.
So once you add that up, no matter, and I just told you, we just talked about it right now, once you add those numbers in, it's going to mess it up because the ratio or the per person is so different.
Right.
So, and that information was from the CIA World Factbook, UN World Health Organization, World Bank.
Well, I'll tell you, the best thing China can do is to not copy us. Don't go down the path of everybody having a car, because it's impossible. There's not enough fuel left in the ground to provide, you know, enough for all those cars. But they said even in China, the amount of space it would take for roads and parking for all those cars, it's more than all their land devoted to growing rice right now. So it's like directly competing with their food production if they went down the path of everyone in cars.
Actually,
and that's, you know, not even looking at the amount of global warming that would add to, and, you know, all the other issues.
Actually, they can't even do that. There was the one, I don't know if this doesn't sound very true. I remember growing up, and someone said that in Hong Kong, if everyone came out of their buildings, because it's all high rises, right, in Hong
right.
Kong, if everyone came out of their buildings, there wouldn't be place for people to stand.
There wouldn't be room for them all. Wow.
Exactly, and so
and
they can't
foot.
Even go
that's
there.
That's on foot. Imagine if they were all in cars.
Exactly. They can't even go there for the car. So maybe that's why it's not even an option.
Well, I think they realized that they started down the path. They started building roads all over the place. I mean, they still are to a point. But I think just a year or two ago, they realized that the world oil situation is finite and there's no way possible to fuel all their cars that they're anticipating. So they quickly switch gears and are now pouring billions of dollars into building high-speed rail systems all over the country. They're going to build something like 8,000 miles or 6,000 miles of high-speed rail in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they'll be able to move people and keep their economy going and move all their goods, but they won't destroy their country by trying to put them all in cars.
And I found out, even through these statistics, that the United States has the largest freight rail
True.
Of the world.
We are one. We do have one of the best freight. We have a terrible passenger rail, but we do have one of the best freight rail systems in the world, and the demand for it is growing like crazy because it's so inefficient to try to move all of our goods around by truck, and you know diesel fuel is going up so fast that it's people are trying to switch to rail like crazy all over the country.
Actually, tell me, how does that freight rail work? Is freight rail only mainly for raw materials?
Wherever the freight or the rail systems are in place, they move everything. I mean, chemicals and lumber and, you know, even finished goods, you know, rail systems pull into ports, and finished goods that come back from China are loaded on in containers right onto freight and shipped all over the country. I mean, it's a huge operation.
Well, okay, let's talk about that, the freight rail and how that whole infrastructure works, and try to tie that into the transit for the people mover. So I'm Emmy Louie, and we're here with Andy Kuhn from newurbanism.org. So that's www.newurbanism.org, and we'll be back. Welcome back. I'm Emmy Louie. So great. We get to learn everything or something about freight rail in the United States today, and really getting a big picture look at how that intertwines, how that connects with all the different cities in the United States, and how that intertwines with the passenger rail. So Andy Kuhns, let's see, how does the freight take us into the day in the life of a freight rail and all that?
Well, the freight rail in the United States is actually one of the best in the world, because it's the most of the rails, the tracks in the United States, are owned by the freight companies, Union Pacific and CSX, and there's several of them. And that's great for freight shipping, but the problem is they're not interested really in passenger rail. So passenger rail has to take a back seat and kind of work around the freight. So because the freight trains move slow and they're really big and heavy and long and, you know, full of containers and cargo and chemical cars and all, the passenger rail has to deal with that older infrastructure. It's not really updated. It's not upgraded for high-speed trains or anything like that. So that's why passenger rail suffers, kind of at the expense of, or the passenger rail is at the expense of the freight rail, unfortunately. And I guess what happened over the years was that the freight companies ended up owning all the tracks and, you know, focused all their interest and energy onto moving freight, and the passenger rail was probably not very profitable, so they really weren't interested in it. So whereas the freight, I'm here in the Washington D.C. area, and the local metro system runs parallel to the Amtrak trains in several areas, and so when you're standing at the platform, you can see these freight trains go by, and some of them they're going by for 15 or 20 minutes. They're so long, and just container after container, full of stuff, chemicals and lumber and all kinds of goods. I mean, sometimes, you know, hundreds of trains are attached to these, and they just keep going by. So you look at that, and it's hugely efficient compared to if that was several hundred separate trucks, each using fuel on the highway. You know, it's probably hundreds of times more inefficient, you know, each one with a driver, each one with tires wearing out and diesel fuel and all that, compared to stacking them all together on a train is much more efficient. So I think it's now, with the rising fuel prices, I think that the trains are going to just have increased demand. I'm sure they're already experiencing it every day.
What is the relationship to trucks and freight? Because at one time there weren't that many trucks, there weren't trucks at all, right, at one time?
Right. The rail systems were more extensive in early America, and I think it's been a big mistake over the years. They've actually been ripping them up in many places and replacing them with either parks or infill development or things like that. And now we're, you know, going to need those things back, and in many cases they're gone. And so, you know, there's parts of America that the freight is not very accessible, especially the newer southern states and places like that, whereas in the Northeast and up Midwest and places like that, freight on rail is huge. And places like Chicago, there's massive rail yards that are just, you know, acres and acres and acres of multiple, maybe 20, 30 tracks and all kinds of switching areas where they unload the trains and load them onto trucks. So it's like an intermodal station where maybe the train goes from a port where the big ships come in. They load them onto trains, and then they transport them to some of the bigger cities, and then from there they unload them onto trucks, and then the trucks take them to smaller locations where there's not good train service. So I think what's going to happen is that the train system for freight is going to expand and replace some of the, as much of the trucking as they can. That makes sense. And then when it gets down to much smaller deliveries, then it'll go back to trucks, the smaller trucks. You know, these long-haul trucks is what's very inefficient for a truck.
What, you mean the 18-wheelers?
Yeah, but I mean long distance. It's like for, you know, to go from all the way across the United States in a truck is very inefficient for moving freight compared to loading it onto a train with, you know, 200 cars or something long. It's much more efficient to do the long-haul runs by train and then transfer them to trucks for short local deliveries.
Well, even with truck drivers, too, that do the long hauls, it's kind of a taxing job, isn't it?
I'm sure it is.
I mean, not that I know that much about it.
Well, I mean, it's just long hours, just kind of monotonous, just driving for 8-10 hours a day, and then they stop at the truck stops and sleep in the back of their trucks and go on again. I mean, I'm sure it's taxing, but what's taxing them a lot more is how much it's costing them in fuel. I mean, there were recently where some of the truckers were going on strike because they said, you know, we're contracted for set amounts of money to haul a load, and yet our fuel keeps going up and our contracts are not going up. So it's like there's no profit left by the time they're done. So, you know, they drive 3 or 4 days across the country, use all this fuel, wear down their tires and wear themselves out, and they end up with hardly any money left.
You're talking about tires. In your Tree Hugger article, it talks about that basically the roads that we drive on, the asphalt, the tires, that's all oil.
All made from oil. I mean, I don't think most people even have an inkling of how much oil is involved in our everyday life. I mean,
it is, because I started just asking the question. Just start asking the question when you
probably
look at
three
anything,
quarters of the products that you deal with every
exactly.
day come
well,
from oil.
You look at something, anything,
any
and you
every
say,
plastic,
what is it made out of?
Much of the fabrics.
Yeah, that's what
you
I
know.
Mean.
If it's not made directly from oil, there's oil used in running the machines to manufacture it, running the machines to mine the materials, delivering the materials. I mean, it's.
Polyester,
you know,
nylon.
All that is made directly from oil. But think about even like lumber is not made from oil, but it takes oil to run the saws to cut down the lumber, to
mm-hmm.
run the machines to cut it up, to process it, to run the trucks to deliver it. You know, I mean, it's just so integral in everything we do that it's just, you know, almost mind-boggling. We
it
have
is
to
mind-boggling
rethink.
Because I was looking at even like the string that's holding our clothes together.
Yeah.
Most of the string is polyester string.
Which
polyester.
Is all made directly from oil.
It's a blend, because if it was cotton string, it wouldn't last
cotton
very long.
Cotton is not made from oil. That's a natural product. But it takes oil to fertilize the cotton and to, you know, run the mills to process it. And, you know, it's never ending, no matter what you look at.
Exactly.
I think it was National Geographic or Time Magazine a year or two ago had a picture of these people's front yard. And they basically, they got these people to pull everything out of their house and put it in their front yard that was made from oil. And their yard was a mountain of stuff. All the kids' toys, you know, furniture, all the plastics, all the Tupperware, you know, on down the line, even shoes and clothes. And it was unbelievable, this picture. I have to find it again and try to put it in our website.
Well,
because
probably what
just,
we need to do is really use oil for what is really needed.
Right, and stop
like,
wasting it
exactly.
on transportation.
Exactly, like string, like the things that hold our clothes together.
Exactly, because you think about nice Tupperware containers and things like that, that's not wasteful at all, because you hang on to those for 10 or 20 years. Whereas what's extremely wasteful is you go to the store and you buy something and it comes in a plastic container and you pour it into something else and you throw the plastic right in the garbage or the plastic bag. That's a complete waste, because it's a one-use, throw it away. That's a real waste of oil. Whereas,
and you know what I still can't understand? I know we're kind of venting our frustrations here. What I don't understand is what happened at one time when you go to the fast food, before we had paper straws, and all of a sudden we had plastic straws.
Right.
In other words,
I think
somewhere
it was very clever marketing by the plastics industry.
40 years ago, somewhere before we were even born or something, it got transferred to that. So
they probably have a whole team of millions of sales reps traveling all over the country. I mean, years ago there weren't plastic bags either. You go
exactly.
to the grocery store,
exactly.
everything was paper. Now it's like everything is plastic.
So idiotic, though. You're drinking this drink for about 15 minutes,
and you throw
and
the bottle right away.
Straw, but this plastic straw would last for what? Thousands of years.
Yeah. See, that's just
Isn't
an amazing
so
waste of
and
a finite
around,
product.
And we go around accepting that.
I don't think anyone realizes it.
I don't know. Do people think that? Am I the only stupid person thinking this?
Well, I don't think that's being stupid at all. I think that's actually being
person?
Pretty observant.
I mean, like, or is it you and I just thinking these things?
Well, hopefully, as oil prices go up, all those things are going to go up in price, and then everyone's going to rethink it. You know, if it costs you 50 cents for a straw, then it doesn't make sense to just pay 50 cents and throw it in the garbage anymore. You know, so we'll have to start rethinking all of our products, rethinking the design of things,
or,
rethinking.
Exactly. Or maybe the whole straw represents a whole avalanche of the way we even eat.
Yeah.
Maybe it's thinking, oh, well, if we don't have a plastic straw, we have a paper straw, then should we even have straws at all? Well, should we even have cups?
Yeah.
So we start opening this whole bag of worms about how we should eat. Maybe we should go to India and eat on leaves or something.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, you go walk into a McDonald's or any fast food place and look at, let's say, a family of four people sitting there eating a meal, the mountain of garbage that at the end of that meal. You know, there's boxes and straws and cups and lids and bags and paper and, you know, I mean, it's like this big wad of trash from just one single meal for a couple people.
Well, maybe I'm kind of talking to myself. Maybe there is some happy medium where we don't have to be living in a cave, but there's some happy medium where we don't have to generate so much trash.
Oh, we need to, for sure, because, you know, even this whole recycling thing doesn't really make a lot of sense, because that takes a huge amount of energy. I was watching a video on the internet one day recently, and it showed one of these recycling plants. And, I mean, it was like six steps and all these big conveyor belts and machines and processing and separating, and I'm looking at that going, that is just a massive use of energy just to separate all this stuff out. And then you've got this mountain of all these separate products that takes more energy to melt them down and reprocess them. And in the end, it doesn't even make any sense. It just makes more sense to just make, like, the old Coke bottles or milk bottles that you just reuse them. You rinse them out and reuse them.
So we're here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, and we got into the sidetrack to recycling, but it's all part of the same thing about rethinking our lifestyles. I'm Emmy Louie. You're listening to The Emmy Louie Show, and we'll be back. Welcome back. I'm Emmy Louie. So it seems like we're trying to set the record straight about certain things that are related to just being green under that whole category, and some clarifications, really. And one of the things has to do with recycling, and we talked about rails, rails to trails, and how that probably needs to go back to mass transit. There's some other related topics that we need to clarify, but let's clarify the recycling part, Andy Kunz.
Well, I think it's great that everyone got on board and are thinking about this and doing the recycling, but I think we need to step backwards and go, well, wait a minute now. Some of these products and packaging don't make sense to begin with, so recycling them is not really getting to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is to stop producing so much stuff, like so much throwaway stuff, like, you think about years ago, Coca-Cola used to come in glass bottles, and they were recyclable. not recyclable, but reusable. It's a big difference. They would take, the Coke company would take them back, and I think they would even pay you 5 cents per bottle. And they would wash them out and put, refill it with their product and send them back out again. So that's a super efficient way to conserve energy, conserve, you know, materials, and not have so much throwaway stuff. So if you're sending your bottles back to the factory, you're not having to recycle them. Reuse is much better than recycling, because recycling, like I said a minute ago, is just, it takes an enormous amount of energy. Think about glass bottles. I mean, they have to pick them up, ship them back to a recycling place. They spend energy crushing them back into sand, and then spend energy heating them up and trying to melt it back into glass. I mean, by the time you're done, you've used 6 times of energy, you know, through the steps to remake that into something else. So it makes a whole lot more sense. If you buy a glass bottle of water, that glass already has a lot of embodied energy into it, and what it took to manufacture it and deliver it and everything else. So a reusing of things, it needs to be what we really focus on, and kind of getting away from the recycling.
Actually, also when I was in Seattle in the early 90s, like 1990, I was part of an organization that had to do with recycling. And they even said then, of course, Seattle is very progressive in all of these matters, and they lead the nation in a lot of these things, is that a lot of the recycling doesn't get recycled.
Well, because they end up with a mountain of stuff that there's not even a market for it. So then what do they do with it? You know, they just, you know, leave it over in a corner somewhere, or they melt it down, you know.
In other words, people do these things, but do we actually know what ends up happening?
Well, and I think what happened was we all got on board so well, and everyone did it so much that we ended up with too much stuff. So that's what I'm saying. You got to think bigger picture and unwind that whole scenario and go, well, wait a minute. Let's stop producing so much stuff that we need to even worry about recycling. Let's get back to reusable containers and stop this throwaway thinking, because that's very wasteful to begin with. So just to recycle it, you're not really solving anything.
Yes, and there are some related issues in regards to that. There's some things like green building, and there was this article that said the shades of green, and am I opening a huge can of worms when I talk about the shades of green?
Well, and probably that, I don't know a lot about that, but that's probably one of the things, like I was just talking about, is recycling plastic bottles. You think you're being green, but it's probably only a shade of green, because the bottle probably shouldn't be plastic to begin with, because that's a toxic chemical and, you know, takes oil to produce
number,
it.
Right? Unless it's a certain number of plastics.
Well, I mean, any of the plastics, they all come from oil. They all are, you know, put out probably, there's probably toxic chemicals in them. They put out toxic chemicals when they produce them. There's toxins produced when they recycle them and melt them down. And so, you know, that recycling your plastic, you think you're being green, but in the end, you're probably not. That's probably a real light shade of green. And you know what I wonder about is sometimes you buy, let's say, a bottle of water in a glass bottle, say Perrier or something like that. If you look on the side, they'll say, you know, you can bring this back for a 5 cent or 10 cent deposit in the following states. And there's only maybe 6 or 7 states listed on there. And I always wonder, why isn't that all 50 states? Why is it only Maine and Connecticut? Or, you know, next time you see a glass bottle, pick it up and look on the side. And I always thought, you know, that would be the most logical thing for our federal government to do, is make, you know, ban plastic bottles, make everything glass, and make all 50 states pay 5 or 10 cents per bottle, and then you would create all these new jobs in people gathering these bottles and bringing them back to the companies. And you would eliminate this huge mountain of plastic waste.
Another one, similar example, is when I went to somewhere like a home improvement store, and I would buy a stopper for a sink stopper. And it said, in the state of California, the stopper is considered cancerous. And that's the same thing. And I said, well, is it because I'm in California and it's considered cancerous? No, it's the same thing.
It's cancerous everywhere, but it's only California that happens to recognize it.
Yes, and so, and that's the same thing for countries, too, because there's certain things that we use here that are probably banned in other countries.
Well, I know for one is the growth hormone that's in milk. It's banned in almost every country except America. And that, you know, it's for sure known to cause cancer and other lots of other problems. And no other country allows it, or most other countries don't allow it. And yet it's allowed here in all our milk.
And then in, this is another thing, and talking about countries, I went to a fundraiser, and it was for something in Nicaragua, and the person from Nicaragua said that the United States, and I don't know if this is true or not, the person from Nicaragua said the United States wants Nicaraguans to eat the food that people in the United States don't want to eat. And then they want the food that's grown in Nicaragua to be exported to the United States. And the Nicaraguans said no, they want to make their own food so they can feed themselves.
Right.
And not eat the food that the people in the United States don't want to eat.
So I mean, it all just comes down to big business and how they can make the most money. And if, you know, they lobby the government to keep these things allowed so they can keep selling the stuff here, whether it's DuPont or Monsanto or some of these big chemical companies that make this stuff. You know, and then here's the reverse of that. We banned DDT in spraying our food crops with, and yet it's still allowed in Mexico, and we import all kinds of food products from Mexico, tomatoes and grapes and different things like that. And, you know that there's probably DDT in them.
I mean, we're eating it.
We're eating it right back here. I mean, you buy a tomato that's imported from Mexico, take it to a lab and test it. I'm sure it has DDT in it because it's allowed in Mexico. So, you know, it doesn't even... These things have to be sort of international, and you can't just have one side of the border is one rule and the other side of the border is the other, and then the stuff is transporting back and forth.
Mm-hmm. There's actually two other topics that I'm very curious about because we kind of touched on it last time, and these are almost things that seem obvious to us, like we're talking about so far about recycling and what materials are made out of. What about impact fees? I know that's a term that's used in development, and that's saying like impact fees are basically if you decide to build somewhere that you need to pay for the infrastructure that leads up to that development.
Well,
what does the new urbanism stand on impact fees?
The fees are different depending on the municipality all around the country. But I don't think those fees even come close to really paying the true cost of the infrastructure that's needed. I mean, if you're a developer and you're going to build a new subdivision way out in the suburbs, you know, maybe 100 homes or something, you might only have an impact fee that's 1/10 of what it really costs to build roads and sewer and water and power and phone and all that infrastructure and utilities that have to come out to that property. And then all the traffic that's generated, and then they have to widen the roads and all that, that's not all paid for.
So are you saying that new urbanism shouldn't even go there? You shouldn't even be building out there? Or what is the stand on that?
Well, and there's a little bit of debate in the new urbanism movement about that. The people that tend to lean more towards the smart growth side really say that we have so many cities that are not fully utilized. You know, in other words, there's abandoned properties or empty properties or underutilized sites in our downtowns and in our historic centers that it really makes the most sense to fill those up first. Infill all those, and so they're full of people and development and apartments and mixed use and all that before we start building brand new communities way out in the suburbs. Because in the cities, the utilities and the infrastructure is already in place. It's already paid for, it's already there, and it's underutilized. So why would you go out to the suburbs and build a whole new place that requires all new infrastructure when there's other infrastructure that's underutilized nearby? So And there's some in the new urbanism movement that say, well, much of the greenfield things are going to be developed anyway, so we might as well at least get it into a compact walkable form, which does have some merit as well. Because then if you come back later and retrofit the region with rail systems, those places are set up to work with rail, whereas a sprawling community is not set up to work with rail. It's too spread out and there's no center and, you know, no dense town center where the logical place for the rail station would be.
So those two points do make a lot of sense because you have to kind of attack the situation from both ends, it sounds like.
I think so, but I think in this country, property rights and the freedom to develop your property is more powerful than logical planning, whereas in Europe, they have much more central planning. The governments or leading agencies will dictate where development goes. And so it's much easier under those schemes to say, okay, we're not going to allow sprawl at all. So, you know, we're going to keep filling in our cities and keep building near rail systems. And I think really that's what this country needs to do, because I don't think it makes any sense to build anything out in the green fields if our cities are half empty.
That's a great point.
But if there's no one controlling it, you know, and I happen to own a 1,000-acre farm 100 miles outside of a city, there's nothing stopping me from going through the approval process and wanting to develop it. So
that's a good point. So we are talking about infill development, impact fees, and land use. I am Emmy Louie, and we are here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. That's www.newurbanism.org, and we'll be back. Welcome back. I'm Emmy Louie. We're talking about infill development and land use development, and one of the things that Andy and I were talking about is really we need to, If a urban core of a city is not being utilized, we should just use their existing infrastructure before we go out and use virgin or green land and build there. And that's kind of similar to what we're going to do, which is really our whole infrastructure is the whole notion of, do we build a new road versus existing road. And Andy, why don't you take the stage there?
Well, I think we really need to have some value judgments on this and, you know, quantify and look at the cost of these things, because infrastructure is hugely expensive. And when you've already built some and paid for it over the last 50 years and it's not utilized to the full extent, it doesn't really make sense to keep building more. You know, it makes much more sense to utilize what we have to 100% and keep it in good shape and maintain it and get as many people living close together in cities and existing rail systems and things like that, rather than just spending billions of dollars building roads way out into the wilderness.
Well, did you also hear, I heard it from my husband, that somewhere in the Northeast, because there are towns that can't afford the roads, they actually just close the roads altogether?
I haven't heard that one.
Yes, and I don't want to point to any particular state where because they have so many roads and they're in a financial crisis, they just close the roads.
Well, you know how a lot of municipalities have funded, because in low-density suburbs, the infrastructure is so much more expensive because there's less users per mile to pay for it versus in a city where there's the buildings are packed together and they're multi-stories. And so and how a lot of suburban low-density places have funded their infrastructure needs is by continually adding more. It's kind of like a pyramid scheme.
Isn't that strange?
Well, what they do is, you know, they'll get a new Walmart to come in, and then the tax dollars that generates, they pay for the last 5 years of roads and things that they build. And so as long as there's always something new coming in, then you can keep paying your previous bill. But if the new stuff stops, then the whole show comes collapsing down.
But then the show is built on an empty pyramid.
It is, and you know, it's like constantly using your credit card, and then all of a sudden you lose your job, and now you've got this huge credit card debt, and you can't pay it. It's kind of like the way of how America operates. You keep borrowing, and you keep spending, and as long as you know, more money keeps coming in, you can keep borrowing more and keep spending more. But as soon as the train stops, then the whole thing collapses, and that's what's happening now, because the suburban growth is stopping right now with the housing meltdown and the subprime meltdown and all that, and so it's kind of reverberating all the way back to the municipalities that were depending on all that new growth to pay for their last 5 years of growth.
New growth. That word just does not resonate with me anymore. There needs to be another word when they say, oh, America needs to grow. We need to regenerate, because that's what life is all about, is regeneration.
Well, and if you, what's really ridiculous is you look at some of these places, oh, this is the fastest growing region in the country, and yet the population isn't growing. It's just everything is sprawling out into this new development, and then they're abandoning other areas, you know, so it's, you know, it doesn't even make any sense. Why do we keep building all this new stuff when we're abandoning something else and able to produce the people for the new thing?
Being fast growing, whatever it is, fast growing is a really, it's a testosterone booster.
Yeah.
Even where I live, people say, oh, there's 20 people moving into this area every hour. There's 90 people moving to this area a day.
Well, and they're moving away from somewhere else.
I
so
know.
They're abandoning something else to move to the new area.
So, in the end,
you're not really coming out ahead. You've got one thing dying and something else taking its place, and now you know someone's paying for all that abandoned properties and the abandoned shopping centers. And
well, in that spirit, you wanted to talk about that infrastructure article, and tell me the big picture about that.
Well,
how does that relate to all of this as far as the new growth and maintaining?
Well, I think that's
infrastructure.
You know, kind of the American Society of Civil Engineers came out with a report card. This is actually 2005, so I'm sure they've come out with a more recent one, but where they rated the condition of the nation's infrastructure, aviation, bridges, dams, drinking water, the power grid, hazardous waste, public parks, rail, roads, and schools, and transit and wastewater. And basically, not much of it got a good grade. I mean, we're looking at D plus, C, D, 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 you know, all the way down the line. And part of the problem has been what I was just saying, is we're constantly focusing on building new places and putting all our money into that, and we're not keeping up with the maintenance of the old places.
Maybe it has to do with a similar, not even related type of, it's kind of relationships. It's easier just to have a new relationship than work on your existing relationship.
Right. Just divorce your wife and go and get a new one.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't work out, divorce her and go get another new one.
In other words, staying and working it out is just not very glamorous.
This is like the throwaway society, including roads and spouses and homes.
Because that's what we've been talking about the last hour. I was trying to figure out what is the common thread about what we're talking about is the throwaway society.
And I think we have to, throwaway society is does not go in harmony with a sustainable future.
That whole word of throwing away, I can't even handle that. I know when I was growing up, it's like throw away to where?
Yeah,
like flush
there is
the
no
toilet.
Away.
Flush it to where?
It's like all of our car exhaust. It just goes up into the air. Well, now we're realizing it doesn't go away.
Up.
It actually changes the atmosphere and changes our climate, and now we're having to deal with all that.
Well, that's what I think of, too. Away, that whole word of away. Exactly. When I'm jogging, and then there's this truck that's spewing out this ball, right?
Right into your lungs.
Well, and then I'm thinking, is that thing really going away, even if I stand kind of away from it? Yeah, I don't smell it, but like you said, it's making it's creating something in the atmosphere, right?
Oh, well, it's changing the whole climate.
Yeah,
I mean, look at global warming is a direct result of all of this stuff that we've thrown away, mostly in the terms of fossil fuel exhaust and the burning of fossil fuels. And, you know, now we're realizing that that away is our atmosphere that regulates our climate. And so now it's a huge issue. You know, I mean, it's disrupting everything across the board in nature, which all of the stuff that affects us, affects our food production and our...
So going back to, we need to stay and work on the marriage. We need to stay and work on the road instead of leaving town and moving to another town.
Right. I think the what we have to do is get past the throwaway society. The throwaway society concept, it's good for, you know, business if you're the guy selling you the new stuff, but it's not good for the total picture because, you know, all that comes back to haunt us in many ways. So we have to sort of get past this, you know, just constant growth and throw away and get new. And we have to think in terms of, you know, how do we make this sustainable where it's, we use things at a rate that we can reprocess it and all that. And, you know, you pick any area and it's the same concept, the same thing.
It is. We talked about roads. We talked about even buildings. It could
homes.
Be cities, entire cities. You just leave
right.
and go to another city.
Right. Vehicles.
Objects,
yeah.
Relationships.
Packaging, I mean, it's just across the board. We have to really rethink that because, and see, the throwaway society.
We're almost
only,
out of time.
I'll say this real quick. The throwaway society only works when you have cheap energy. And now that cheap energy is coming to an end, the throwaway society is going to come to an end with it. And we're going to have to revalue things and reuse them instead of, you can't just keep throwing them away because you're not going to be able to afford to keep making new ones.
Okay, great. Okay, so the throwaway society hour that we just talked about with Andy Kunz, thank you so much for being on the show and talking to us and really just kind of bringing to light the kind of mentality that we all accept as true or we accept as okay when in point of fact it's kind of ludicrous.
Right. Well, thank you for having me.
Well, okay, thank you, Andy. I'll see you next time, okay?
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Andy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.